TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Israel-Palestine, Through the Lens of Settler Colonialism, Professor Ilan Pape. Here's the question and answer section. Following a talk by Israeli historian Ilan Pape, he spoke at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on March 24, 2017. Professor Pape had challenged the audience with his conclusion that the Israel-Palestine conflict can no longer be resolved by the so-called two-state solution. Instead, Pape said, the only resolution must be one democratic state for Palestinians and Israelis, with equal rights for both. This radio program presents some of Ilan Pape's thoughts, how this may become a reality. Disinterested observers who have watched years of fruitless negotiations may welcome what might be the only way out of the impasse and alleviation of the suffering it causes. Pape's opinion, to be sure, will be rejected by those who insist that Israel remain a country with rights and privileges for Jews that are denied Palestinians, whether they are Israeli citizens or living under occupation in the West Bank. For those who do not wish to hear Palestinian rights discussed, I offer again a disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed in the following program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of this radio station, its staff, or board of directors. Professor Ilan Pape has achieved a high degree of credibility, not only because of his scholarship, but because he is an Israeli. Born in Haifa and educated in Israeli institutions, and was a senior lecturer in political science at the University of Haifa. His critique of the guiding ideas that went into the founding of Israel in 1948 is based on painstaking and often painful research. He received world attention as one of Israel's new historians when his most influential book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, was published, and the global attention it received led both to his chosen exile from Israel and his acceptance at the University of Exeter. He's now a professor of history with the College of Social Sciences and International Studies at Exeter in the United Kingdom. Since 2014, the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs and the Institute for Research, Middle East and Policy have held annual conferences on the Israel lobby and American policy, along with noted Palestinian political figure Hanan Ashrawi. Professor Ilan Pape was a 2017 keynote speaker. Pape chose the topic, Israel-Palestine, Through the Lens of Settler Colonialism. When the United States and the former colonial powers that controlled the Middle East decided that the Palestinians had to give up land to a new Jewish state, it was not intended to be a 50-50 division.
Of course, it was never suggested by any mediator, whether they were Americans or non-Americans, that the land would be divided 50-50. But even the idea of 22 and 78 or the 55 and 45 of 1947 was based on this false analysis that what you have in Palestine is a genuine struggle between two national movements. Zionism is not a national movement. It's a settler colonialist movement. And the Palestinians, before they become a nation, they are first and foremost the native indigenous people of Palestine.
Professor Ilan Pape, since the founding of Israel in 1948, when more than 700,000 Palestinians were forced to leave or expelled, Israel has occupied more land than was assigned to them by the United Nations. As of 2017, Palestinians live under de facto Israeli military rule on only 22% of their former homeland. Pape's argument is that Israel keeps Palestinians in fenced-off disconnected areas that constitute a system of apartheid. Since 1967, Israel has facilitated the movement of several hundred thousand Jewish settlers onto Palestinian-occupied land, creating a situation in which a two-state solution is no longer possible. Here now is the Q&A session where Ilan Pape had a chance to lay out how a one-state solution might come about. The moderator was Deos Prusansky, the assistant editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs.
Most of the questions here revolve around one point here, and that's what exactly a one-state solution would look like. So one person asks, what happens to the Palestinians? Another asks, how do Israelis, settlers, Palestinians, refugees coexist? What happens in that first day, week, year, decade?
Right. Yes. Well, building a different political structure from the one you have is a long journey. And any attempt to answer all these questions would be wrong because, first of all, as I said, you have to remove the one conversation that does not allow you to invest the same energy as you've invested in the last 50 years in the wrong solution. So I would put it to 2 points about this. One is, as I think there is already a one-state solution, we don't need to build a one-state solution. What we need is to change the regime of that one state. We need to make it a democracy, because now it is not a democracy. Now, you build it by a slow movement from below and not by big revolutions, as the Arab world has learned, unfortunately and painfully, in the last 6 or 7 years. It is time, I think, for academics, pundits, and people who have the time and the energy to try and begin to build models of a joint curriculum, a joint judicial system, a joint political solutions for questions of symbolism, such as names, the identity of the state, and so on. I don't think it's time for a political movement to do it as yet. It's too premature. I'm just saying we have to start this conversation. And there are more and more movements from below that define themselves as a one-state movement. We talked about the BDS a lot today, but there's also an ODS, the One Democratic State Movement, from below. Now, this group of people, whether they are activists, whether they come from different walks of life, begin to give answers to the question that you are asking. But I think more than anything else, I'm always surprised when I'm sort of listening to John Kerry, re-listening to John Kerry's last speech. If you remember, he was in a very dramatic voice. He explained to us that without a two-state solution, the only possible scenario is an apartheid Israel. And I wanted to say, hello, John. How are you? Looking up. The one-state apartheid is already there. So your warning is not about the future. You're actually describing the present. Secondly, couldn't you find one moment in your speech, maybe two sentences in your speech, to say that actually having a democratic state for Jews and Palestinians between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean is not a doomsday scenario? Couldn't you just say, wouldn't it be wonderful to have settlers and natives living as equal citizens in the same state? Why do you have to describe this as a doomsday scenario? The only people in the world who would describe this as a doomsday scenario are Zionists, because they think that when the Jews are not a majority, the only possible thing Palestinians can do is to kill them. Well, I lived in Haifa all my life. I live in the Galilee. I was in political outfits and academic outfits where the Jews were the minority and nothing bad happened to us. And the idea that Palestine cannot be a political outfit if the Palestinians are the majority and the Jews are a minority is a racist idea that should be challenged strongly.
So a question about the role of the Palestinian Authority in an official rather than a de facto one state. How would the Palestinian Authority go about disbanding, and what would that look like?
Right. Well, I think anyway Israel is going to eventually disband the PA, so it's not my agenda. Exactly, I'm not a prophet. I don't know exactly how it will unfold, but I have no doubt that the way Israeli politics is going and the way American politics is going and the level of the decreasing level of interest in the international community about Israel and Palestine, given all these factors, I have very little doubt that there will be a moment where the reality that already unfolded, namely that Israel controls the West Bank, and in many ways controls the Gaza Strip, despite of what the Hamas may feel, that this de facto reality would be declared as a de jure reality. There's one interesting and significant development in the West Bank that people have not noticed. In the last few months, Israel has removed half of the checkpoints in the West Bank. So when I noticed that, I said, is it because an American president is coming? Because the last time they did it was before Obama's visit, and then they returned the checkpoints 2 days after he left. No, they have removed most of the checkpoints from Area C because they regard Area C, which is 55% of the West Bank, as part of Israel. And they don't want Israelis to move around a state which has checkpoints. It doesn't look nice. It doesn't feel nice. So the checkpoints are only in area A and B and between area A and B and C. Now, the next step is to do the same for area B. Maybe area A would remain, greater Ramallah, as a Palestinian enclave. I doubt whether at that moment in time there would be enough Palestinians to say, this is what we were fighting for, a nation state in area A. I'm very blunt with you because I think I don't want to spend another wasteful year of talking the wrong language about a reality that I know very well, and this language has nothing to do with that reality. So it's not a matter of saying the PA should go or shouldn't go. The PA belongs to a narrative and a story that has nothing to do with the reality on the ground. And that story is going to change. In fact, it's already changing. It's just a matter when people are willing to use the right words to describe a reality that they don't like, for various reasons, to acknowledge.
A couple of questions about BDS. One person asks, would you say that BDS is the only way to achieve decolonization? And what are the possible outcomes of the movement?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing we shouldn't do is confuse BDS with a vision. We need the Palestinians to redefine what the liberation of Palestine means in the 21st century. We cannot rely on nostalgic ideas of the 1960s. Neither do I think the political Islamic movements have a vision that is going to work. So we need a redefinition of the Palestinian Liberation Project. And sometimes people, I think, confuse the means, which is the BDS, with the need to rethink the vision, the project of liberation. Now, however, as I said before, the outside world cannot be indifferent to the suffering of the people just because we are in this limbo between a project, the two-state solution, that is irrelevant, is not going to work, and as I said, is in the morgue for a few years, but we haven't noticed, and a new project which will take quite a while to build, because we need a unification of the Palestinian side. We need a more authentic representation. We need a lot of things to happen for us to be on the road towards this new vision. But we don't have the luxury of remain idle and indifferent while the clock of destruction, which is faster than the clock of reconstruction, is working. And therefore, the BDS is so important. Because the BDS is there to say, yes, there is a void of leadership. Yes, there is a chaotic moment in history where there is no peace process and there's no alternative to that peace process. But that doesn't mean that we, as the international community, have nothing to do and can do nothing in order to stop the suffering of the people on the ground. And the greatest thing about the BDS was that it introduced to us again the two groups that the Oslo process brutally excluded from the future of Palestine, the Palestinian refugees and the Palestinian minority in Israel. And we should be thankful to the BDS for reminding us that the people of the West Bank and the people of the Gaza Strip are only half of the Palestinian people, and that these two territories are only 22% of Palestine. And you don't cure an illness by dealing with the hand if the whole body is ill.
So earlier today in his keynote, Mearsheimer suggested the idea of an expulsion is unlikely. But lots of people here seem to be worried about it because I'm getting lots of questions about this. So one person asks, what exactly is stopping another mass expulsion? One person says Netanyahu realizes the two-state solution is dead but doesn't want one state with Palestinians. So how, you know, what's stopping him from trying that again as in 48?
I think John is right in the sense that it's difficult to envisage an ethnic cleansing on the scale that Israel committed in 1948, expelling half of Palestine's population, demolishing half of Palestine's villages, and destroying almost all the Palestinian towns apart from Nazareth. Yes, I agree, this is difficult. But I think what is important to understand that ethnic cleansing is a paradigm as much as settler colonialism is. And the Israelis perfected the notion of ethnic cleansing and adapted it to the 21st century much better than any other political movement that I know in history. For instance, they found out that actually you can achieve the same goal of having a space without the people in it by not allowing people to leave the place in which they live. You don't have to expel people from villages. You can enclave them. You can siege them in villages. And you get the same result. Namely, you don't have demographically to include the enclave, imprisoned, incarcerated people in your demographic balance, which is the most important thing for a settler colonial state. And even liberal people around the world somehow agree that Israel has the right to talk in these racist terms as if this is acceptable. So you don't need massive expulsion in order to annex Area C. For instance, you can, and they're already doing it. I don't know how many of you have been to Anata, how many of you have been to the Shuafat refugee camp, how many of you have been to Tul Karem, a whole town that is surrounded by a fence with one gate to the town in the hands of the Israeli soldiers. It's a big jail. And the only reason people are incarcerated in this jail is because they are Palestinians, for no other crime. Now, this is the model Israelis on the left like, because they are against expulsion. They are against expulsion. They say expulsion is an Israeli right-wing notion. Our notion is separation, or as they call it in Hebrew, hafrada, which means in English apartheid. Hafrada, segregation, in more literally. We really believe that it's much better for the Palestinians to be incarcerated, enclaved in homogenic Palestinian areas. They don't even need green lungs, the Palestinians, because they're not a Western modernized society. And we can keep it forever like this, because we have hundreds of thousands of Israelis who are part of the police state that manages. This is not an occupation that manages the colonization of Palestine, whether it is in the Nakab, in the Galilee, in the Gaza Strip, or in the West Bank. There's no need for mass expulsion. You have built an amazingly big apparatus that so many Israelis are involved in, that you have the manpower to police daily the control over 6 million Palestinians within the one state that you have created 15, 16 years ago, and still even sell this to the world as a democracy that unfortunately had to occupy a certain area, but of course is looking for the right Palestinian partner to get it back to them. We are still hearing this bullshit today, unbelievably. Thank you.
Question about terminology here. One person says, why didn't you choose to label the Palestinian suffering as genocide instead of ethnic cleansing? And this person contends that Palestine is the classic example of the UN's definition of genocide.
Because I think there is a difference between genocide and ethnic cleansing. I did use the term genocide for Gaza. I called it incremental genocide, and this was reiterated by the United Nations report last year that talked about the de-development of Gaza in 2020, which means the Gaza Strip is under such circumstances that massive death of people and young people is inevitable. So it becomes an incremental genocide. But for me, genocide is also a term that talks about intention and ideology and racism. Now, there is kind of in between, but that's a bit too scholarly, and I don't like to use it in a world of activism, but I'll do this. There is something in between the term of genocide and ethnic cleansing that, again, if I'll refer to Patrick Wolf, who I mentioned before. Patrick Wolf is, for those of you who haven't read his work, I really recommend this. He has an amazing article called The Logic of the Annihilation of the Native. Maybe I'm a bit, as I said, it's 2 o'clock in the morning for me, so maybe it's not annihilation. Where's Andrew? Andrew, are you there? The elimination. I knew it was wrong. Thank you. He's my student, so he knows he has to be awake and answer these questions even at midnight if I ask him. Okay. Yeah. So the title is The Logic of the Elimination of the Native. And he refers to all the settler colonial societies, including in this country, in the South of America, in Australia, New Zealand, and so on, in which he explains quite simply and very convincingly that the people who escaped or fled from Europe in the last 3 or 4 centuries because of all kinds of persecutions and looked for a new homeland encountered native populations that they believed they had to eliminate for the success of building this new homeland. Here, it resulted in genocide. The same happened north of the border and south of the border. Also in Australia, it ended in genocide. In South Africa, in Palestine, in Algeria, the methods of eliminating the native as an obstacle for creating the new homeland was not genocidal, but it was bad enough. It was bad enough. So yes, you can talk about the elimination of the Palestinians as a natural consequence of the logic of Zionism of all its shades and colors. However, elimination in the 21st century with international focus on human rights and civil rights, with the internal wish of the Israelis to be part of the democratic world, and maybe even genuine Israeli impulses of democracy, elimination becomes something far more complex than what I associate with genocide. And in fact, we saw the need for an accurate conversation when the terrible events unfolded in Syria in 2011. We, as activists on behalf of Palestine in the West, struggled to keep Palestine as an issue when people said to us, but how can you compare what happens to the Palestinians with what happens in Iraq, what happens in Syria? And we were trying to say, yes, but you know, we are talking about the same brutality, the same inhumanity, But we're talking about a span of 100 years, not 4 or 5 years. And this incremental inhumanity happens every day. And when it happens on a daily basis, it's not very dramatic. It doesn't catch the media's attention. And you can put it aside compared to the huge massacres and horrible things that are happening in Syria and Iraq. And this is where the idea of settler colonialism as a structure is so important. And this is why it's not necessary to talk about genocide as much as it is necessary to say that the DNA of the settler colonial state of Israel is to continue the project, as I put it in simple terms, of having as much of Palestine with as few Palestinians in it. Now, they have the whole of Palestine. In the last 50 years, they don't have a geographical ambition anymore. Israelis of all kinds do not want to occupy Lebanon, Jordan, or Egypt. They are satisfied with the borders that they have today. They have a demographic issue, not a geographical issue. And when they deal with a demographic issue, they found a formula that one should say is working, unfortunately. And that formula says you can police 6 million Palestinians and still the world will believe you that this is a temporary oppression. And still the world will believe you that you will stop this oppression once peace will arrive. And you still can convince the world that you are the only democracy in the Middle East and the oppression of 6 million people is not a relevant item when you analyze a country as a democratic state. This is the importance of analyzing what's happening in Israel as a settler colonialism that can sometimes result to genocide, sometimes results to ethnic cleansing, and quite often results to a charade of peace that provides it a shield of immunity from any genuine rebuke and condemnation in the global community.
Professor Ilan Pappé, Israeli historian, currently teaching at the University of Exeter in the UK. He spoke on the topic of Israel-Palestine through the lens of settler colonialism on March 24, 2017 at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. The Washington Report on Middle East Affairs and the Institute for Research, Middle East and Policy co-sponsored the 4th Annual Conference on the Israel Lobby and American Policy. You can find links to the video and transcript of this and the other talks at the one-day conference on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.